Major funding for the series is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from PRI, Public Radio International.
This is Crossing East, our stories, our history, our America. I'm Margaret Cho.
The killers of Vincent Chin really never spent a day in jail.
They charged him with 59 counts under the Atomic Energy Act of 1954. There was never any charges formally of spying.
Saigu in Korean means April 29th. About 2,280 Korean-American owned stores were looted or burned down during the riots.
We changed how drivers were being viewed. We changed the imbalance of power in this industry.
Japanese community was the first one that came to show support after 9/11 for the American Muslims and South Asians. They have been through the same thing.
When we return, new waves, new storms on Crossing East.
I'm Dimae Roberts with the Crossing East music feature. Aishwarya Venkataraman started playing violin when she was 18 months old. Aishu, as she's called at home, is now 13, and she's carrying on the traditions of South Indian Carnatic music through her violin.
The violin is just your basic violin. It looks just the same, but the tuning is what makes my instrument very different, very unique. The tuning is not your standard G, D, A, E. It's more of an F, D, F, D with two octave intervals. The way we play it also makes a very big difference. I'm going to play the basic scale in the Carnatic style with the bends and twists. Honestly, I didn't really choose the violin. Being only 1.5, 2 years old, I really didn't know how to think for myself. So that's where my parents kind of helped me along and told me, you know what, today we're going to start you off on the violin. And that's pretty much how I chose.
Aishu comes from a long line of master musicians. Her grandmother studied with T.N. Krishnan, considered a living legend of South Indian classical music. Aishu is now studying with the same teacher.
I have a class at least once, twice, maybe even three times a week. Not a second is wasted. Every second, I've learned something new. My teacher, he is, like, out of this world.
Aisha's father, Vinod Venkataraman, accompanies his daughter in concerts. He plays the drum.
It is a double-headed barrel drum. The word mridangam itself means, mri means clay, and angam means body. So mridangam basically means a body of clay. You have to be able to recite the drum syllables before you are able to play it on your drum. It is very similar to rap. You bring it to body and soul before you can bring it to the drum. 5, 6, 7, 8.
Vinod is an ethnomusicologist and math professor. He came to the U.S. in 1987 to teach at San Diego State University.
My family originated from southern India in the princely state of Kerala, the southernmost tip of India, a beautiful, beautiful place. Music just flows in the water, in the tap waters of Kerala. Anybody who comes from Kerala, two things always happen. They know how to cook and they know how to play music.
Srividya Venkataraman, Aishu's mom, is a physician who also came from southern India.
I came to this country after I got married to my husband. My husband and I had an arranged marriage. Soon came Aishu and then I had Aparna. And looks like we are permanently settled here.
Aishu goes to middle school just like any other kid, but she starts the day practicing music for 2 hours with her dad, and then when she comes home, she does her homework and practices more into the evening.
The practice is so rigorous, at least 4 to 5, 6 hours a day, just to get maybe one line, two lines, just to be ready for the next class.
If you want to attain a certain level of perfection, the only word that will take you there is practice.
Aishu and Vinod form a group called Divine Strings, and they perform around the world. Aishu has already been accepted to the summer program of the Berklee College of Music in Boston.
I hope to get a degree in performance and finish that degree before high school is over. I'm also very good at math and science. So after music, I'd also like to, you know, explore my options in the fields of medicine.
And her parents share and support her dream.
I am sincerely hoping that she will continue to strive for perfection. She will continue to aim to reach the highest pinnacle and hopefully win a Grammy or something in the field of world music.
I think Aishu will make a great performance artist. And she also wants to become a doctor. She states she wants to help me with my practice. So I hope she can do both in the future. We live the music that we hear all the time.
To find out more about Divine Strings, visit crossingeast.org. This Crossing East music feature was produced by Maria Estevez with funding by the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Dime Roberts.
I'm Margaret Cho, and this is Crossing East, New Waves, New Storms. The 1980s and 1990s ushered in a time of hope and change for Asian Americans. In 1981, Congress, under pressure from the Japanese American community seeking redress and reparations, held hearings across the country. After hearing the testimonies from more than 750 witnesses, the Commission on Wartime Relocation concluded the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II was indeed a grave injustice. And in 1988, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act, authorizing a formal apology and $20,000 in reparations to every survivor of the camps. The next two decades would usher in a generation of Asian Americans who would continue to rise up against any new grave injustices. While some Asian Americans participated in civil rights struggles of the 1960s, others bought into the new stereotype of the model minority. There was a strong belief if one played by the rules, anyone could succeed in America. But two events greatly challenged the model minority myth and galvanized Asian American communities: the 1982 killing in Detroit of Vincent Chin and the 1999 accusations of spying against Wen Ho Lee. Chapter 1, New Movement for Civil Rights, by Reese Ehrlich.
Chin got into an argument with two men, 43-year-old Ronald Evans and his stepson Michael Nitz. Witnesses say that Evans made some cracks about foreign cars, putting Americans out of work.
In the documentary film, Who Killed Vincent Chin, a policeman describes what he saw that night.
Mr. Nitz had to grab Mr. Vincent Chin in a bear hug while Mr. Evans swung a bat, repeatedly striking Mr. Chin. Full contact, full swing.
Journalist Helen Zia, who helped found the Justice Committee for Vincent Chin, says while she considered the killing a hate crime, many in the Detroit Asian community initially did not.
One of the dancers at the bar heard very clearly. They said things like, nip, chink, and then said, it's because of you motherfuckers that we're out of work. A lot of people who very much felt that they should lie low, don't make waves, were not that comfortable even using the word racism.
The Asian American movement did start in the 1960s and largely in the Bay Area. It came as part of or on the heels of ethnic studies and the Black Power movement.
Bill Hing is a professor of law and Asian studies at the University of California, Davis.
Even the term Asian American didn't really come of age until the 1960s. When the Vincent Chin case came along, that woke up a generation of new Asian Americans in the country who had not been politicized by the Asian American Studies movement.
In Detroit today, a federal grand jury indicted two men convicted earlier this year of murdering Chinese American engineer Vincent Chin. The indictments
and
came
there was a federal civil rights trial that actually took place in Detroit. They decided that Ronald Ebens, the man who wielded the bat that crushed Vincent's skull four times, was guilty of violating Vincent Chin's civil rights. So Ronald Ebens was sentenced to 20 years. That case then was appealed. The defendant won on appeal. The sentence was overturned and a whole new trial was ordered. Then it was moved to Cincinnati, which was a whole different location. As few Asian Americans as there are in Detroit, there were even fewer in Cincinnati. The foreperson of the jury was a laid-off factory worker who had a profile incredibly similar to the killer. And so they acquitted Ronald Ebens. He was then freed. The killers of Vincent Chin really never spent a day in jail. Well, even though there was a sad ending in terms of no justice for Vincent Chin himself, there was an incredible legacy left behind. It really politicized an entire community to understand the whole notion of civil rights and civil participation.
Reverend Norman Fong headed up the Vincent Chin Justice Committee in San Francisco.
There's two Americas to me. I really feel that there's the side that is mythical. Everyone can make it in America, right? The melting pot, and everyone's colorless and classless. And then there's the real America, too, which is one of struggle. I mean, we have to fight to keep the democratic principles alive in America.
Federal grand jury has handed down a 59-count indictment against Wenho Lee, an American nuclear scientist suspected of espionage. Mr. Lee worked formerly at the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico.
While the Vincent Chin case galvanized students and working-class Asians, the case of Dr. Wenho Lee woke up middle-class and professional Asian Americans. Dr. Lee was a respected physicist working at the Los Alamos Laboratories in New Mexico. The Taiwan-born Dr. Lee was repeatedly questioned about nuclear secrets given to mainland China.
He met with the FBI on over 20 occasions without an attorney, each meeting lasting sometimes up to 4 to 5 hours. So I really believe that my father thought he was helping the FBI with the investigation, did not know that he was the target of the investigation.
Alberta Lee, Dr. Lee's daughter.
They charged him with downloading or mishandling classified information. They charged him with 59 counts under the Atomic Energy Act of 1954. There was never any charges formally of spying. My family was just in shock that this could happen in America. We really always believed that you come to the United States and you work hard, keep your head down, and don't rock the boat. We were never really awakened to discrimination in America until this case happened to my father. We pretty much kind of lived what's known as the model minority type of existence, where we just didn't really care about politics very much and floated along through life.
Professor Bill Hing.
Initially, I think that the Chinese American community and the Asian American community didn't know how to react. There were some in the community who thought, well, maybe this guy could be a spy, and others thought, no, he couldn't be.
Helen Zia.
In the work group of 70-some other scientists where Wenho Lee worked, there were a handful of other scientists, maybe a dozen or so, who had the same, quote, profile as Wenho Lee, who had visited China on lab business, but none of them were taken seriously as suspects. None of them were investigated. Wenho Lee was the only person that the government ever investigated. He was Chinese American.
Dr. Lee's daughter, Alberta.
Having support from Chinese Americans was absolutely crucial in raising awareness. But once the scientific groups, once the American Physical Society, the National Institute of Sciences, Committee for Concerned Scientists, once so many scientific groups came on board to support my father to write letters to Janet Reno, that was when the tide really began to change. That was when it was no longer an issue about race, but also an issue about scientific matters as well as our nation's defense.
Former Los Alamos nuclear scientist Wenho Lee has been released from jail 9 months after he was detained for illegally copying data on classified missile technology. Prosecutors settled with Lee on condition that he plead guilty to one of the 59 counts.
U.S. District Judge James Parker, who presided over this case, had harsh words for government prosecutors. He called the case against Wenho Lee an embarrassment to the nation and asked the federal agencies who filed the suit to apologize to him.
I think in both Vincent Chin and in my father's case, Chinese Americans realized that they did need to be much more vigilant, much more politically aware, politically involved, and they need to also be cognizant of stereotyping that occurs somehow among the masses in America that Chinese Americans are perceived to be a certain way or another way. I think in both situations also, Chinese Americans organized ad hoc overnight in casual manners and informal manners to really rally to support the person that was involved.
The Vincent Chin case and the Wenho Li case really do give us reason to feel that even in the face of injustice, you can actually fight back. It does take people coming together. It does take a social movement. And out of those social movements come greater preparedness for the future.
Speaking publicly for the first time since his incarceration, Li made it clear he was pleased to be out of jail.
I'm very happy to go home with my wife and my children today. And I want to say thank you to all the people who support me. I really appreciate very, very much. And for next few days, I'm going to fishing.
Most of the time, he's okay. He's dealt with this in his own way. He's actually printed a mathematics textbook on linear algebra, as well as a couple of publications in international journals. But I think he remains unsettled with his position in the United States. It's still a continuing process to heal from the pain.
New Movement for Civil Rights by Reese Ehrlich. Hear more stories on our website, crossingeast.org. I'm Margaret Cho. Next, a watershed moment in Korean American history.
Saigu in Korean means April 29th. In Korea, important historical dates are remembered by the day it occurred. Just like 9/11, in Korean community, Saigu remembers what happened on April 29th, 1992 in Los Angeles.
Los Angeles is reacting with violence to the verdict in the Rodney King trial. Riots, looting, vandalism, and arson.
It's like a living hell. It's a war zone.
Businesses were looted. Motorists were pulled from their cars and beaten.
I guess the first few nights it was a lot of anger about the verdict, so you saw burning, looting, vandalism.
And people who were not of African descent were being pulled out of their cars and nearly beaten to death, especially if you were Korean or if you were white. A lot of people were afraid, so they started closing down their stores. People started hearing over the radio Korean store owners were being attacked.
Look at that TV, all looter and stealing and hitting, and daddy, don't go. We have insurance. Don't go. And she start crying. I stay home and I see TV and start burning the other liquor store, all the liquor store, shopping center.
Serve and protect who? We don't feel that the blacks and the minorities are being served.
Racial violence took place for another 3 days. The official ending was about 6 days after.
An uprising in Los Angeles, or a racial riot. In a moment. This is Crossing East.
In this segment, we featured the music of John Jang. Support for Crossing East comes from this station and Public Radio International stations and is made possible in part by the PRI Series Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Thank you.
I'm Margaret Cho, and this is Crossing East, New Waves, New Storms. Perhaps one of the worst riots in U.S. history began in Los Angeles on April 29, 1992. 3 days and four nights of demonstrations, civil disobedience, rioting, looting, and arson ended with 55 people dead, nearly 2,300 injured, and another 10,000 arrested. More than 1,100 buildings were damaged or destroyed in sections of South Central Los Angeles and nearby Koreatown. More than 13,000 National Guard and federal officers were called in to patrol a city that looked like a bombed-out war zone. Though much has been reported about the riots, little has been said about its devastating impact on the Korean-American community. Korean convenience stores that sold liquor were especially targeted during and after the riots. Even less has been said of how Korean Americans rose to the challenge of the tragedy, leading to perhaps the largest protest organized by the Asian American community. Chapter 2. Saigu.
Saigu in Korean means April 29th. About 2,280 Korean American owned stores were looted or burned down during the riots.
A neighborhood shopping center burned to a heap of smoldering ash. Neighbors huddle in small groups, shaking their heads in disbelief.
For people from immigrant families that were not so well off, there was just complete confusion about why is this happening? America's not supposed to be this kind of a country.
And then that time they called me, Adan, you store burning. So my wife cried, my daughter and me cried, and I didn't respect the burning. We're thinking so much, how are we going to be living?
As the violence moved out of South Central Los Angeles and spread, a sniper on top of a building shot at me.
They announced over the radio that they needed young, able-bodied male Koreans to come and protect Koreatown if they were willing. And so we came out, we brought our guns, we brought our willingness to protect our community. At the time, the police were nowhere to be seen.
2,000 members of the National Guard are on the streets. California.
There's a lot of poverty, you know, that exists in urban communities in this country. You know, the riots broke out in several major cities across the country because of the Rodney King verdict. Many people felt like the system had taken advantage of them. So stores, supermarkets, shops, people saw it as a free fall. Here's a chance to go in and be able to, you know, get some goods and some things that we feel like we need. A lot of people lost their businesses, not just Korean Americans, but also African Americans, Latino Americans. Many people lost their business as a part of the riot. It wasn't directed towards any specific person.
The Korean immigrant merchants were put in the context by American society to play the role of middleman, that they serve as a buffer between the dominant white group and subordinate black and Latino community. So by functioning as a middleman merchant, they are the one who gets all the day-to-day interaction with underclass customers, in this case African Americans, and therefore they become a target of resentment, hatred, anger.
They're going crazy. Everybody's going crazy right now. Like the black gangs, the white gangs, the Korean gangs, anybody could drive up right now.
Probably two-thirds of South Central Los Angeles has been incarcerated or had some type of incarceration. The kids and the adults in these communities suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder and hypervigilance. This is a war zone. It literally is. If South Central Los Angeles weren't in the United States, there would be humanitarian aid in here helping people to deal with the after effects of war. There would be peace envoys here.
This was not a product of black-Korean tensions. It really wasn't the reason why LA imploded. I mean, we had really huge problems with our confidence in the police department. We had huge economic problems.
And sometimes when people see, oh, this individual has a liquor store, they think that these people are making millions of dollars. They don't understand the business, you know, of running a market. They don't understand that you're making 1 and 2 cents markup on canned foods and 5 cents on a bag of potato chips. They just think people are making millions of dollars, you know, because they might drive a nice car and different things like that.
Korean immigrants came here believing that America is a land of opportunities, land of immigrants, land of freedom. Therefore, anyone can make it if you work hard. On the other hand, African Americans who had to endure historical oppression, discrimination, and racism, they are the generation of poverty, unemployment, and all they have witnessed outsiders always come in and profit at their own expense. So those clash of ideology really didn't help either because they began to blame each other.
King's beating on March 3rd, 1991 was was videotaped and triggered a year of local and national outrage.
I think the media had a huge role, actually, that it played in shaping the animosity or hatred toward immigrants, especially from Korea.
There was a shooting incident in South Central LA. The news broadcast an isolated incident when a Korean store owner shot a young teenage black girl, Latasha Harlins, and she died. The store owner was only sentenced to community service, and the black community was outraged, and so was I.
And that shooting incident was captured by the security camera that were mounted in a store. Everybody knows about Rodney King beating videotapes. So those two videotapes were aired constantly every day until April 29th, 1992. So media simply not only showed those videotapes, whenever there were Korean-African-American conflict or boycott of Korean stores, they would show either tapes. They were repeatedly forced to watch those two videotapes, which sends a certain message. If you're an African-American person, you could face a brutal beating by LAPD officers. And if you're an African-American customer, you could face a possible murder by Korean-Americans.
You saw in Koreatown probably 90 to 100,000 people gathering in the International Park area. It went on for blocks and blocks and blocks, and people peacefully marching together from all parts of the city, literally cleaning up the streets as they went.
Many of the participants were Korean Americans, but there were others, Latinos, African Americans, white Americans. It was multi-ethnic, and they all came together in peace and justice. Instead of blaming, instead of pointing out the whole destruction, they wanted to come together. I think that's a very important historical lesson.
The new day brought no peace. Wherever you look, there were new pillars of black smoke.
About a week later, and still smoking, so let them burning and sit there and stay home and depress. Then I say, what is this letter? And I show to my daughter, honey, what is it? Daddy, you cannot open store.
During LA riots, about 150 to 200 Korean-American-owned liquor stores in South Los Angeles was totally burned down. And many of them wanted to rebuild their stores. And yet, LA City Council passed ordinance requiring store owners to go through public hearing processes.
City government gave them to so much hard time to reopening, to give them zoning problem and planning problem to open store.
Many resident, African-American residents protested rebuilding of Korean-owned liquor stores, arguing that there were too many. During the hearing process, residents argued that they need more security. Therefore, if you wanted to rebuild the stores, the Korean store owners were required to hire a security guard or limit sales of liquors between sunup and sundown, which almost made it impossible for them to make a decent living.
And city government should have helped us. They didn't protect a good citizen. We licensable and tax person, good citizen, they didn't protect us to burning to all the store. And they give me start getting problem to reopen back the store.
It really was an unfair process. There was such animus toward Korean store owners who had type 20 and 21 licenses, which are beer and wine or hard liquor licenses.
3 years stay home, I used all that funding money, so that's why I lost my house and everything.
There were people who committed suicide. There were people whose families were literally destroyed because of the fact that these are immigrants. They don't speak the language. They don't have support networks here other than maybe church communities. So families were pretty devastated beyond just the loss of a business.
The garage, the walkways, the offices were dark and deserted. The air was still and bitter with smoke.
Right after the riots, there were lots of corporations and political leaders visiting South LA, Koreatown, promising this, promising that. A year after that, what happened? It's all forgotten. No one really is paying attention. No one is saying anything about it. All the promises came and gone. And that's the reason why all the knowledgeable people are saying it's going to happen again, because we haven't done anything to improve the conditions that erupted the racial violence.
I think that the LA riot was a precursor to something else that hasn't happened yet within the culture. We are being totally emotionally desensitized to violence against one another. I think that we're being pissed pitted against each other on a large scale.
The fact of the gap between the wealthy and the poor growing, except now we're talking on a global scale. And so if people are feeling that they want to work and they can't because there's just nothing, and if our housing crisis continues, if we continue on where our solution to dealing with problems in our community is to jail young people for long periods of time without any thinking that these are young people that are coming back to our communities, we're just asking for another 1992.
Saigu by Dime Roberts and Mia Kim.
Featured voices in Saigu were Edward Chang, Associate Professor of Ethnic Studies at the University of California, Riverside, Attorney Angela Oh, Don Myung, owner of Trojan Market, Akila Sherrill, Executive Director of Community Self-Determination, Inc., and Sunny Kang. Chin Do Arirang was performed by Chang Hae Jin and Maria K. Seo, and was provided by Jack Straw Productions in Seattle, Washington, through their Traditional Artist Support Program.
In April 1998, New York City laid out 17 new rules that increased fines for taxi drivers and made it easier for them to lose their licenses. A majority of the drivers came from India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, countries that had taken up arms against each other just decades before. But the city's taxi drivers were angry enough to do what many said couldn't be done. They organized. For one day, they walked off the job and went on strike and proved they were a force to be reckoned with. Chapter 3, Taxi Turmoil by Deepa Ranganathan.
Here comes the passenger.
Hi.
Hi.
You're taking Fish
to 46th and 1st?
46th and 1st? All right. Rizwan Raja was an accountant's apprentice in Pakistan. He started driving a cab to be his own boss.
I think that's the really only thing which keeps the cab drivers in this business.
Taxi driving becomes an attractive proposition for one single reason.
Biju Matthew is a volunteer organizer for the New York Taxi Workers Alliance.
Unlike a bodega, right, or unlike a restaurant wherein you'll get minimum wage or below, when it comes to taxi driving, the difference is that you might end up with $1,500 or $2,000 in a month. But there is always a chance that you can make more.
In 1998, New York City taxi drivers were targeted by Mayor Rudolph Giuliani's Quality of Life Initiative. The Taxi and Limousine Commission handed down 17 new rules. Insurance costs for cabs and drivers skyrocketed. Fines tripled for smoking in the cab or treating passengers rudely. And if a driver racked up two tickets in 18 months, say for following another car too closely and then forgetting to give a passenger a receipt, his license and his livelihood could be suspended.
For a taxi driver, getting tickets on the street is the equivalent for a factory worker getting grease on his hands. It's working conditions.
Biju Matthew.
So in a situation like this, you're hanging a sword over a driver's neck saying, you make two mistakes and you're dead.
And treating passengers rudely. My God.
Rizwan Raja.
I mean, 99.99%, we are on the receiving end of the rude conversations rather than treating people rudely. So to me, it looks like preparing the general public for a huge crackdown on immigrant labor.
Just member after member after member walked up to us and said, you know, we have to strike.
Bhairavi Desai was 23 years old when she started organizing taxi drivers a decade ago. Now, she's executive director of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance.
Like, enough is enough. You know, we're not reckless. You know, we have to send a message that we're not going to take it. We had general members taking the flyer, spending money on their own to copy it. And then they would call back to the office and report in. You know, I just copied 200 flyers. I'm standing at the corner at Houston and Broadway. And so we just flooded the entire industry with the message that on May 13th, 1998, we're going out on strike.
But taxi drivers were hard to organize. They were scattered all over the city and they competed for customers. Though many had immigrated from South Asia, the drivers didn't have a common language or culture.
drivers would always talk about the fact that you have people from so many different countries, and that makes it more difficult to be organized. And certainly there were tensions between the Indian and Pakistani drivers.
In the early days of May 1998, India carried out 5 nuclear tests. Pakistan responded with 6 tests later that month. It was hard for drivers to ignore the political struggles in their home countries, but in their cabs, these differences were invisible to most taxi customers.
Most of the riding public are middle class and upper middle class people, and you know who are they in this city. So we are being treated in a way that which reminds us every single moment of it, that where I'm come from and which is my identity. Whether you are Puerto Rican or a Pakistani, whether you are a Uruguayan or an Indian, you all look the same, all are brown. That helped us in organizing that strike.
6 o'clock morning, Queensboro Bridge is always full with the yellow cabs coming to the Manhattan for work.
Javed Tariq is a Pakistani cab driver.
But at that day, I did not see a single cab crossing the bridge.
There were just no taxis anywhere. There were just like lines and lines of people waiting around, waiting for a cab. And we just walked up and down the street saying, no, not today, but you're better off going into the subway. You know, better take that bus, you know.
New York City police estimated 90% of drivers were on strike that day. The strike's organizers said 98%, about 23,000 drivers. The same month, a different taxi group, the United Yellow Cab Drivers Association, planned a motorcade protest. But the city yanked its permission, and Mayor Giuliani threatened to arrest the drivers. That's when a deputy police commissioner allegedly told the press that the drivers were taxi terrorists.
Which was like a slap on the face of working class. And remember, there was no 9/11 in the horizon. We are talking about 1998.
We felt very bad about this because we were hardworking people and we were fighting for our economic situation. And we live in this country. We love this country.
We couldn't have had a better organizer than Mayor Rudy Giuliani. I mean, who was a bully, who was, one, enacting the most unfavorable policies for drivers, and two, who was willing to talk about drivers in the most disparaging terms. So any self-respecting person would respond to that in a way of wanting to defend themselves.
A week later, the drivers finally received permission for their motorcade, but they had to cross the bridge too early in the morning to attract much notice. Hundreds of drivers packed a public hearing in Manhattan and spoke to the Taxi and Limousine Commission for 7 hours that day. But it was clear they weren't listening to drivers. Taxi and Limousine Commissioner Diane McGrath McKechnie.
This reform package was long overdue. It was a direct result of the Mayor's Quality of Life Initiative, and it was a direct result of a consumer response. The day of that bad, unsafe, reckless driver is over.
The commissioners passed all but 2 of the 17 rules. Although the city council stepped in and weakened the toughest of the rules, fines went up, and it became a little easier for a driver to lose his license. Technically, the strike wasn't successful, but some organizers and drivers still claim victory.
We changed how drivers were being viewed. We changed the imbalance of power in this industry. It was such a beautiful event to see a group of working people who had such amazing courage.
This also actually opened the doors for other unions to think critically that, yeah, we can fight back.
Taxi Turmoil by Deepa Ranganathan. You can find out more about our stories on crossingeast.org. In a moment, a high-tech return to coolie labor. This is Crossing East.
Archival material was provided by WNYC and NPR. Our featured music is from Aishwarya and Vinod Venkataraman of Divine Strings. This is PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you.
I'm Margaret Cho. We're talking about new waves, new storms on Crossing East. In today's global economy, job security is fast becoming a dream of the past. The 1990s brought a new type of worker. In row after row of cubicles across America, immigrant labor powers the high-tech industry. Beginning in 1990, the H-1B visa program brought thousands of temporary workers from South Asia to fill vacant jobs in technology and education. Since 9/11, policy debates on immigration have intensified. Problems for workers range from discrimination on the job to being fired at a moment's notice. Without a job, there's no visa, and a worker must leave the country almost immediately. Chapter 4, H-1B Blues, by Ginger Miles.
The H-1B visa process is completely voluntary. No one is holding a gun to these people's heads saying apply for these jobs. But just because it's voluntary doesn't mean it cannot be abusive.
These are folks that are highly educated with a high level of English speaking capacity, and they're being treated no better than undocumented immigrants.
I'm Rajiv. I was on the H-1B visa. I came back to India after staying in the United States for 14 years. I personally went through some issues wherein at 9/11, I was racially profiled while I was there on the H-1 visa, and my company just threw their hands up and they had nothing to do with it. This resulted in me and my wife and my daughter returned back to India. All charges against me were dropped, and then we came back here and didn't go back to the United States. After 9/11, there was abuse from American colleagues, technology workers. H-1B workers are lowering wages. So H-1B workers are kind of subdued in their attempts towards making their opinions known out in the public for a fear of getting another backlash coming in from local citizens. Presently in India, I run an organization by the name of www.nostops.org, and it's an open source database of visa sponsors.
To post your resume for free on this H-1B database, for potential sponsors and employees to contact you directly, please click here.
Obviously, this is a very tech-savvy group. They have tons of chat groups on the internet, job networking websites where you can pose your questions.
If you need further clarification from a registered immigration attorney, please click here.
My name is Shivali Shah. I've been an advocate for immigrant rights for the past 10 years. And for the last year and a half, I've been conducting the H-Visa survey, which is a survey of H-1B holders and H-4 visa holders.
I'm Sharmila Rudrappa. Presently, I am on an H-1B, and I'm an assistant professor in sociology and in Asian American studies. Can I transfer my H-1B to another company?
To transfer your H-1B, you need valid employment in the U.S. Also, you have to prove that you have recent pay stubs, at least 60 days old.
There's the promise of the green card coming down the road. They might be actually much more exploitable than our citizen workers. And this is where you start seeing the abuse of the H-1B system.
The consultant companies, called body shoppers, will sponsor an employee's visa. And instead of the employee working for that particular employer, the employer will get contracts from larger companies to hire out an employee for a fixed term.
Now, say I own a company that basically runs as a body shop. So what I would then do is I would send my workforce to go do that job for maybe 2 months, maybe 3 months, finish that project, and bring my workers back. For that, I would get a lump sum of money that is contracted to me. But the kinds of pay that I give to the workers, I would pay them pitiful amounts of money.
For the Indian employee whose first job experience in the U.S. is with one of these consulting companies, they're not going to know any better. In a lot of cases, this is not all of them, but for the ones that do this, they have the employee sign an agreement in the beginning that they will allow the employer to take care of all of their taxes for them. When the tax return comes, they end up cashing the tax return themselves instead of giving it back to the employee to whom it rightfully belongs.
If you have any issues regarding payment from your employer, you should contact your local Department of Labor.
There was one fellow that I had spoken with who had raised a very mild, minor question about why his allowance was a couple thousand less than it had been in previous months. A few days later, he was told that his company would no longer pay for the medical benefits for his pregnant wife and his two other children, and that he had to pay for them himself. 2 weeks after that, he was told that he had to go back to India.
How long can I stay here after being laid off?
Leave the country as soon as possible to avoid any potential legal issues.
And this is another problem with the H-1B law, is that the minute your connection to the employer is no longer there, you don't get a grace period of a few months to wrap up your affairs and go home. The minute you are either fired or you quit from your job that is sponsoring your H-1B, you need to wrap up your affairs and go home. My goals in doing this survey, this research, and the advocacy that I'm doing are to change laws that create an exploitative situation for H-1B workers who are working for consulting companies, as well as for the H-4 dependent spouses.
I came to the United States when I was 21. I would like to come back, but not in the current H-1B visa program. I would definitely like to arrive back wherein I could feel respected and have some dignity of labor. U.S. respects individuality, there's freedom of choice, and I think I miss that, and that's the only thing I can give my daughter, something to look forward to for her future. And I would rather go back to a place where I feel it's my home, because that's where my heart belongs.
H-1B Blues by Ginger Miles.
Japanese community was the first one that came to show support after 9/11 for the American Muslims and South Asians. They have been through the same thing.
Samina Fahima Sundas holds a lit candle as she and hundreds of others walk from San Jose's Japantown to the South Bay Islamic Association in California. This candlelight walk for peace on the 2004 anniversary of September 11th is one of the many events where Japanese and Muslim Americans are joining together because the attack on the Twin Towers produced another wave of racial violence. Our final chapter for New Waves, New Storms, Racial Profiling, Then and Now, by Robin Takayama.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jean Cochran. Two planes crashed into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center in New York this morning.
As American symbols of power collapsed into rubble, taking thousands of lives, a fear of homeland insecurity spread across the country. Some turned against people they associated with terrorists, simply because of the color of their skin.
The backlash has hit every region of the country. In Chicago, a pro-American demonstration got out of hand when several hundred people converged on an Islamic center and began chanting anti-Muslim slogans. In Seattle, a man was caught pouring gasoline.
Regardless of whether you've been born in the country, you don't speak with an accent, you feel as American as anyone else around you, they see you as belonging to a larger group of people whom they don't feel belong in the country.
Deepa Iyer, with South Asian American Leaders of Tomorrow, speaks of the targeting of Muslims and South Asians after the 9/11 attacks. But this is not the first time a community has been singled out during a national crisis.
On December 7, 1941, Japan, like its infamous Axis partners, struck...
Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor brought the United States into World War II. The bombing also launched an internal attack on Americans of Japanese descent, especially on the West Coast.
Three tall white men came knocking on our door, and they just all showed a little card, and it said, Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Yuri Kochiyama returned home to her father in San Pedro, California. He was recovering from surgery just the day before the attack on Pearl Harbor.
And then they asked if Seishi Nakahara lived there, and I said, oh, yes, that's my father. And said, where is he? And I said, he's sick, he's in the back sleeping. They just went right in the house, woke him up and told him, put on your slippers and bathrobe. And everything happened so fast, I didn't have a chance to even ask, where are you taking him?
This story foreshadows what happened to many families right after September 11th. Hundreds of men from South Asian or Middle Eastern countries were swept up and detained.
My name is Bobby Khan, and I'm interpreting for Malik Ali. I was hearing it from the people, those were regularly going to the mosque, that FBI and INS is cracking down where predominantly Pakistanis and Muslim community is living.
Deepa Iyer.
Their men, their fathers or brothers, were taken away to detention centers, were interrogated, were investigated, and were denied access to their own family members, were denied access to counsel, were part of the disappeared in America.
In the first 48 hours after the attack on Pearl Harbor, more than 700 Japanese Americans were rounded up. Yuri Kochiyama's family discovered their father, still recovering from surgery, was taken to a federal prison on Terminal Island. He was interrogated for hours at a time as a prisoner of war. 6 weeks later, her father returned home in an ambulance and passed away the next day. The family had little time to grieve because on February 19, 1942, President Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066. All Japanese Americans living on the West Coast were ordered to inland internment camps. Yuri Kochiyama.
It was only what you could carry. We just could not carry anything that could be used as a weapon. I mean, no knives. I don't think they let us bring chopsticks, no radio.
More than 110,000 Japanese Americans were moved to 10 internment camps throughout the United States. Once released at the end of the war, the Issei's, Japanese immigrants, had to rebuild their lives from scratch.
Issei's lost their homes, they lost their work, their income, everything. I mean, self-determination, civil rights, they lost really everything.
When the Japanese were interned, the only group that stood up in protest to their internment were the Quakers.
John Oda is the Reverend at Pine United Methodist Church, an historically Japanese-American church in San Francisco.
It's sad that no one else stood in opposition to this illegal internment. You know, that's one of the reasons why we were very quick and very strong to stand up and to be here.
Right after 9/11, vandals destroyed large glass doors to the Islamic Center of San Francisco. Pine United raised funds to help replace these doors and became a sister church to the mosque. Many Japanese Americans quickly spoke out against a repeat of mass roundups and incarceration after 9/11. But the government did implement another form of racial profiling. The Department of Justice instituted the Special Registration Program in September 2002. Malik Ali first heard about it at his mosque.
Actually, just look at the same masjid that we came.
I was very much afraid when, after the prayer, I heard that some INS official is speaking. They just said that you should come for registration. We will be giving you legal status.
But special registration was not amnesty. The program required men 16 years and older from 25 designated countries to present themselves to their local INS office for fingerprinting and interrogation. Deepa Iyer.
I remember community members saying that I want to go, but I'm really afraid of what could happen to me, and I'm not sure whether I should go or whether I should just stay under the radar screen.
When I entered into the Federal Plaza, it was very crowded, and I was not explained what to do. After about 10 hours, some agent took me to the 10th floor for the investigation. And when I was taken there, they asked me to sit on a hard bench. And someone was threatening very loudly, harassing that you should know who you are and you better cooperate with us. I was told that you will not be returned your passport. It will be a judge, immigration judge, who will make a decision about you and he'll put you in the prison.
Deepa Iyer.
Definitely, as more and more stories came out about immigrants under this program going in and then being detained and being deported, this definitely created another wave of fear.
I had no choice left except to pray that God showed them that we are innocent people and we should not be treated like that. We should not be intimidated. We should not be put in the prisons. We should not be deported.
The special registration program wrapped up in April 2003. Nearly 83,000 men voluntarily complied. 13,000 men, including Malik Ali, received deportation orders, primarily for minor visa violations. No one was charged with terrorist activity.
Our next speaker is going to be Yuri Kochiyama.
The reason I felt it was important to speak out right away is because the U.S. has been doing the same thing over and over. They had one law after another, you know, where Japanese could not own land, Asians could not become citizens.
And throughout our country's history, many groups of people have been framed as the other because of their skin color or their last name or their country of origin without looking into their individual culpability.
Amid this backlash from the government and individuals, committed alliances have formed across racial lines and between religious communities. Samina Fahim walked among a crowd of hundreds at a 2004 9/11 candlelight vigil.
So I think we just need to stand together, and it is the kind of thing that we need to make the most beautiful, diverse human wall of support and strength for one another. We are together. We are going to be one body, trying to protect everyone.
Racial Profiling, Then and Now, by Robin Takayama. And so our story, our history as Asians crossing east to America, continues. The lessons of the past, of the land of promise and opportunity, of Gold Mountain, of refuge and safe haven, of finding a community and a voice as citizens. These lessons, these dreams, continue. As long as we remember, we tell, and we write. Our stories, our history, in our America. I'm Margaret Cho, and this is Crossing East. Crossing East is produced with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and individual donors of Media Rights Productions. Our featured music is by Divine Strings. Our theme music is by Shasta Tycho from their CD Spirit Drum. Our lead scholar is Judy Young, Professor Emeritus of American Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Managing editor is Catherine Stifter. The associate producer is Sarah Caswell Colbert. The Crossing East engineer is Clark Salisbury, with technical assistance by Michael Johnson. Marketing and outreach by Ping Ka. The executive producer is Dime Roberts. To find out more about Crossing East or for more information about Asian American history, go to crossingeast.org. Support for Crossing East comes from this station and Public Radio International stations.
PRI, Public Radio International.